rape. He bragged to Gilbert that he had been tried 12 or 13 times. "I've had lots of trials. That's old stuff." He also had experience with the Nuremberg prison itself, having been imprisoned there before the war for a sex crime. He told Kelly he slept well in jail because of his clean conscience. Sex and violence were his abiding interests. He was so obsessed with sex that he questioned children about their sexual activities and told them about his nightly wet dreams. He enjoyed beating people and found that he could work off his tensions by whipping prisoners. In the prime of his power, after yet another session with his riding whip, Stryker acknowledged the sexual frisson. "Now I am relieved. I needed that again." Stryker was proud of his prison record. At the peak of his power under the Nazi regime, he ordered that a plaque be mounted on his former cell, honoring his former residence. The cell, he bragged, had even become a pilgrimage site for visiting Nazis. However, his prior jail experience did not make it any easier for him when he was imprisoned by the International Military Tribunal. Although he looked brutally tough, the stress of the situation weighed on Stryker. He repeatedly woke the Nuremberg cell block, screaming in the gloom of the night, and he developed cardiac arrhythmias. Throughout it all, he tried to maintain his morale by exercising in the nude in his cell, thereby disgusting his guards. Multiple observers commented on Stryker's unusual physical appearance. British Major Airy Neave noted that Stryker was like an ape exposing himself in a cage at the zoo, or like a subject in an indecent 16th century woodcut who looked like a medieval torturer, bared to the waist, pitiless, and enjoying the smell of burning flesh. The reporter Joel Sayre added his description. "Although only about 5 feet 6 inches in height, he weighs around 190, and his thick, underslung body is a seemingly inexhaustible storage battery of Nordic vigor. His head is shaped like an egg, and the only thing on it is a pair of bushy eyebrows and a mustache, which is practically a replica of the Führer's. Perhaps the most arresting feature of his face is his eyes, their blue areas blazing, their whites apparently stitched on with red thread. Beneath his chin hang dewlaps like those of a prize mastiff." Rebecca West described him on a deeper level, noting, "Stryker is pitiable, because it is plainly the community and not he who was guilty of his sins. He is a dirty old man of the sort that gives trouble in parks, and a sane Germany would have sent him to an asylum long ago." As the interrogators soon learned, it wasn't just his appearance that was peculiar. His behavior itself was wildly counterproductive. During his prison interrogations, Stryker was strikingly argumentative and unrepentant. In one interrogation, he insisted on his innocence and that of the Nazi party, stating, "Whatever happened here was the result of a superhuman being, Hitler." Stryker was a gifted rabble-rouser, whose speeches and writings inflamed audiences. His devoted readers sent him letters about the evil machinations of Jews, and he gleefully recirculated them in the anti-Semitic tabloid weekly Der Stürmer, The Attacker. For instance, a patient in a mental hospital wrote that Jewish doctors were drugging him with opium to drive him mad and conspiring with his fellow patients to keep him up at night by pretending to be ghosts. Stryker filled the pages of Der Stürmer with such stories and worse, tales of Jewish ritual murders, sexual depravity, and proofs that the Jews were responsible for Germany's massive unemployment and ruinous inflation, that they had swarmed in from the east and taken over the best businesses and land. Der Stürmer reported that Jewish doctors were poisoning their patients, and that even when the Jews appeared to be doing good deeds, it was for sinister motives. During his interrogation and trial, the Allies rapidly zeroed in on various articles Stryker had published. Question: did you approve the article where he used the word exterminate? Answer: exterminate and destroy are two different words in the German language. At the moment I am speaking about destruction. This word, destruction, was used by the Führer. In the German language, when I say that somebody's life should be taken, I would use either killed or murdered, but I think kill would be the right expression. Extermination can result by sterilization. The word extermination does not necessarily mean killing. That clarification could hardly help his case. He wasn't necessarily advocating killing prisoners, perhaps just sterilizing them. On October 20, 1945, the defendants were formally indicted. When Streicher received his indictment, he said, "This so-called indictment is Reinwurst, pure baloney. They must have their victims. I am suspicious of such international justice. International jury is a better description." The International Military Tribunal offered a list of possible defense attorneys, but Streicher refused to choose one because to him, all the names on the list sounded Jewish, and he wanted an anti-Semite as his defense counsel. In a decision that was so emblematic of the man, he settled on Dr. Hans Marx, a former Nazi Party member. The other defendants carefully reviewed the list, thought about the implications, and tried to make a judicious selection. Streicher saw Jews everywhere. He was sure, for instance, that Justice Jackson's real name was Jacobson, and that Eisenhower was Jewish. He distrusted Gilbert because he felt that all psychiatrists and psychologists were Jews. He had his doubts about Kelly as well. Whatever his political views, Marx had an extremely difficult client to defend. Streicher kept digging his own grave, and his behavior was both so damaging to his case and so peculiar that the court requested a psychiatric examination by outside experts. The Russians, usually so utterly convinced of the defendant's guilt, actually initiated the request because Streicher told them that he was really a Zionist at heart. As a result of this startling confession, the Russians had certain doubts as to his mental stability, and Streicher's attorney had so many problems dealing with his client that he also requested a psychiatric examination. Three psychiatrists were summoned from Russia, France, and the United States. In contrast to the extensive psychiatric reports filed on Hess, the experts' findings about Streicher were succinctly definitive. Defendant Julius Streicher is sane. Defendant Julius Streicher is fit to appear before the tribunal and to present his defense. It being the unanimous conclusion of the examiners that Julius Streicher is sane, he is for that reason capable of understanding the nature and quality of his acts during the period of time covered by the indictment. The case against Streicher was presented on January 10, 1946. Although his day in court was relatively brief, the legal issues in his case were unique. He was too despicable even for the Nazis, who forbade him from making speeches in autumn 1939 and placed him under house arrest starting in 1940. It was thus difficult for the tribunal to prove that he had conspired to start the war or commit war crimes. Instead, the tribunal accused him of zealously fomenting race hatred so long and so effectively that this constituted crimes against humanity. The prosecution relied on Streicher's writings and speeches as evidence of his incitements to violence. The historical record was very ample on that point. Streicher had written, after all, "One single cohabitation of a Jew with an Aryan woman is sufficient to poison her blood forever. Together with the alien albumen, she has absorbed the alien soul. Never again will she be able to bear purely Aryan children, even when married to an Aryan. They will all be bastards, with a dual soul and a body of a mixed breed. Their children, too, will be crossbreeds. That means ugly people of unsteady character and with a tendency to illnesses. Now we know why the Jew uses every artifice of seduction in order to ravish German girls at as early an age as possible, why the Jewish doctor rapes his female patients while they are under anesthesia. He wants the German girl and German woman to observe the alien sperm of the Jew." Elsewhere, Streicher advocated the death penalty for Jews who committed race pollution and urged Germany to invade Russia to rid the world of all Jews and communists. They must be utterly exterminated. Then the world will see that the end of the Jews is also the end of Bolshevism. Streicher presented his defense on April 26, 1946, and was cross-examined by the prosecution on April 29th. Seeking to draw him out, the prosecution asked whether he thought he had promoted race hatred by writing that Jews were a nation of bloodsuckers and extortionists. Streicher's response, "It is not preaching hatred. It is just a statement of facts." His pugnaciousness made a bad impression on the tribunal, and even his fellow defendants regarded him as contemptible. During Stryker's testimony, Goering whispered to Hess, "Well, at least we did one good thing, getting that prick Stryker kicked out of office." Another defendant told Gilbert, "Well, they've put the rope around his neck after all. At least our end of the dock thinks so." On his one day of testimony, Stryker got into a loud argument with his attorney. He was furious that Marx wouldn't introduce proof of the existence of ritual murder. Instead, his attorney argued that, because Stryker was so widely disliked by the Nazi Party leadership and had been out of office since autumn 1939, he could hardly incite anyone effectively. This strategy, truthful though it was, so humiliated and incensed Stryker that he adamantly denied that he had been stripped of power. He became increasingly belligerent in response to his attorney's questions and shouted out that Marx was doing a bad job and was not presenting the defense in the way Stryker wanted. In response, the justices threatened to have Stryker evicted from the courtroom unless he quieted down. Justice Jackson even tried to get him cited for contempt. As the old adage goes, the tongue is the enemy of the neck. In his defense, Stryker argued, "Show me one person who said he had killed Jews because of reading my paper." He claimed that he did not know of the killings and couldn't be blamed for them. "I never wrote, 'Burn Jewish homes down, beat them to death.' Never once did such an incitement appear in Der Stürmer." Additionally, he claimed that his goal was merely to get the Jews to a homeland of their own, outside of Germany, ergo his Zionism. In his closing arguments, Jackson ridiculed Stryker's testimony. "A Gauleiter of Franconia, whose occupation was to pour forth filthy writings about the Jews, but who had no idea that anybody would read them." The Assessments of Gilbert and Kelly. Gilbert described Stryker as rigid, insensitive, and obsessive. "He considers the Bible pornographic literature and has no use even for Christ because he was a Jew." Stryker was a master at offending everyone he came into contact with. Even after his long-time house arrest for offending Goering by asserting that Goering couldn't have fathered a child, Stryker couldn't help himself and salaciously repeated the allegation again to Gilbert at Nuremberg. The following interchange between Gilbert and Stryker gives a sense of their interactions. Gilbert to Stryker, "Why did you have to print all that sexual filth about the Jews?" Stryker, "Why, it's all in the Talmud. The Jews are a circumcised race. Didn't Joseph commit race pollution with Pharaoh's daughter? The judges are crucifying me now. I can tell. Three of the judges are Jews." Gilbert, "How can you tell?" Stryker, "I can recognize blood. Three of them get uncomfortable when I look at them. I can tell. I've been studying race for 20 years.
Gilbert wrote about Stryker in his diary. "A quarter of an hour with this perverted mind is about all one can stand at one time, and his line never varies. World Jewry and circumcision serve as the channels for projecting his own lascivious thoughts and aggressions into a pornographic anti-Semitism." Gilbert asked Stryker how he could recognize Jews. Since this topic was a favorite of Stryker's, he jumped right in, but his answer was a tad unusual, the Jewish behind.
"The Jewish behind is not like a Gentile behind. The Jewish behind is so feminine, so soft and feminine, and you can tell from the way it wobbles when they walk."
Gilbert tested Stryker's IQ and noted that it took Stryker a whole minute to do a simple mathematics problem. How much change he would get from 50 pfennigs if he bought 7 2-pfennig stamps? Gilbert felt that Stryker had no true psychiatric diagnosis, but had an abnormal paranoid personality. Gilbert concluded, "There is neither sadism nor shame in his attitude, just a cool, apathetic, obsessive quality." After hearing the prosecution's summation on July 26, 1946, a considerably subdued Stryker confided to Gilbert that he was ready to help the Jews now.
"I'm ready to join and help them in their fight. The Jews will dominate the world, and I would be happy to help lead them to victory."
Kelly also made extensive observations of Stryker. He regarded Stryker as a paranoid anti-Semitic fanatic who had systemized series of beliefs, which were founded purely on his own emotions and prejudices and not on known facts. In other matters, he was essentially rational. Kelly was intrigued by Stryker and remarked, "He was a man who lives and succeeds by emotion almost exclusively. To have seen Julius Stryker lounging on his cot, a bald, paunchy, loose-skinned man in cast-off GI work clothes, one would have found it hard to believe that this creature had once held thousands of sensible Germans spellbound." Stryker saw himself as a hero who was being sacrificed by Jews. He told Kelly, "The entire history of the world has proved that the bearers of truth and understanding are always a minority. I am one of that small group. The knowledge of belonging among the pioneers of the truth gives me the inner strength to survive all hardships of these trying times." Kelly wrote a brief summary of Stryker on December 13, 1945. He described Stryker's mental status exam as normal, but under "thought content," Kelly scrawled, "reveals fixed belief in Jewish persecution secondary to self-suggestion for many years." He then added his typical boilerplate sentence for all of the war criminals. "This man is competent and demonstrates no evidence of psychopathology. He is able to face trial." In contrast to this laconic summary, Kelly had a lot to say about Stryker's Rorschach and concluded that it revealed a normal personality with strong, extra-tensive features, responses shaped primarily by emotion and impulsivity. Stryker's stress tolerance, measured by a combination of movement and color responses, was surprisingly high, but his other responses suggested that he was under significant amounts of stress, as inferred by an overrepresentation of shading responses. In terms of inkblot content, Stryker reported many anatomical responses: skeletons, anatomical specimen, hip bone, blood, preserved meniscus. Such responses are traditionally viewed as markers of depression. He was, after all, in prison and facing trial as a war criminal, a situation where one would expect stress and depression responses. In a January 5, 1946 prison document, Kelly wrote, "Stryker represents an extremely earthy type of individual who, unable to gain recognition of the world, has become fixed with an idea. This belief has become, in time, an almost true monomania. There seems little doubt that he actually believes it, and this belief will undoubtedly carry him through the trial. He is of only moderate intelligence, and his only accomplishment is measured in the firmness of his almost delusional belief. He is obviously quite sane, as his ideas, while false and odd, cannot be classed as true delusions. They are, of course, false beliefs, but he has sought to prove them for so long that he at least actually has converted himself." A later Nuremberg psychiatrist wrote, "Stryker impresses me as an old psychopathic personality with sexual and other conflicts, whose inadequacy found expression in an obsessive preoccupation which for the past 20 years had filled the narrow stream of his life." A perspective from the 21st century, with a nod to Cicero. All the observers commented on Stryker's paranoia, a term that ranges from a variant of personality style all the way to psychosis. Few evaluators felt that Stryker was psychotic. Rather, his suspiciousness, violence, and sexual depravity seemed to reflect a lifelong pattern of behavior. Repugnant beliefs and actions reflect moral failings, but not necessarily psychiatric disorders. Yet Stryker's suspicious preoccupations do raise some troubling questions. Are rigidly held and distasteful political views instances of psychiatric disorder? That question becomes particularly challenging when such views are widely held in a culture. Contemporary psychiatrists and psychologists exclude such culturally held beliefs as a basis for a psychiatric diagnosis. We cannot treat a culture even if its beliefs are grounded in error or incite violence. Stryker is arresting because his behavior was off scale, even for the Nazis. He was not just another violent, corrupt, ideologically committed anti-Semitic Nazi. Instead, for Stryker, anti-Semitism was more central to his being. It was his North Star, so to speak, a beacon that guided his actions. Autobiographies intrigue me, not just their content or style, but because they reveal how individuals sift through and select the features of their life that they wish to emphasize. While waiting in jail, in October 1945, Stryker wrote two autobiographical statements. The longer text, 2.5 typed single-spaced pages, devotes 60% of the space to his belief that the Jews were dangerous. He also composed a short handwritten letter in response to Kelly's request. To Major Kelly, I have been born on 12th February 1885. I had 3 brothers and 3 sisters. I am the 5th of the children. I am a writer. I used to be Gauleiter in Franken. He caused the east wind to set forth in heaven, and by his power he brought on the south wind. I feel physically healthy. Julius Stryker. The letter starts with a formulaic statement about Stryker's family, and then claims his identity as an author and a party leader. But the embedded quotation from Psalms, chapter 78, verse 26, is unusual and seems out of context. One could read it as a statement of humility, fatalism, or grandiosity. In any event, it suggests something other than his habitual paranoia. But Stryker was unusual in other respects as well. His relationships with his fellow Nazis were characterized by continual arguments and remarkably poor judgment. The man could not stop himself, and his malicious gossiping about Goering almost got himself killed, only to be rescued by a sentence of house arrest for the duration of the war. Then there were all those sex crimes. Stryker's behavior was certainly facilitated by National Socialism, but something else was going on as well. He would probably meet criteria for a personality disorder. Personality denotes the enduring pattern of an individual's life, his or her climate, so to speak. We all have bad weather in our lives, bouts of cloudy, stormy times that can in some instances be severe, but personality is our individual climate, and in Stryker's case, his climate was aberrant, marked by corruption, suspiciousness, violence, and sexual assault. Personality patterns have always been a hazy area in psychiatry. We all know people who are belligerent, distrustful, compulsive, or morose. Others are mercurial, odd, or infatuated with themselves, and many people manifest a fluctuating mixture of all of these traits. When these ways of relating to the world become glaring and inflexible, they constitute full-fledged disorders. More often than not, these disorders are shapeshifters with unclear contours. Personality disorders are diverse. Many patients suffer profoundly from their personality disorders. Some of them make others around them suffer. Many are repulsive individuals. Others are capable of being quite charming. If one had a long list of adjectives for describing Stryker, I do not think anyone would describe him as charming. My house is strewn with books. One night when I couldn't sleep well, I picked up Cicero's Tusculan Disputations and was startled to come across his description of personality patterns run amok. From the perspective of 45 BCE, Cicero commented that people are troubled by all kinds of depravity and perversity. There are more disorders of the mind than of the body, and they are of a more dangerous nature. The mind, when disordered, can neither bear nor endure anything, and is under the perpetual influence of desires. These depravities, Cicero noted, are deep-seated and driven by societal forces. When the multitude who declare unanimously for what is wrong, then we are altogether overwhelmed. You would think he was writing about Stryker under National Socialism, but perhaps I am skirting a central issue. If Stryker, against all odds, had straggled into the office of a psychiatrist or psychologist, he would probably have been diagnosed as having some form of personality disorder, a long entrenched pattern of distorted relations with others and disrupted sense of identity. In any context other than a therapist's office, he would be regarded quite simply as bad seed, argumentative, violent, corrupt, suspicious, depraved. In Chapter 12, we shall consider whether individuals like Stryker reveal a different perspective on the nature of malice. The execution. It was policy. Before each man was hanged, he was asked his name. Stryker refused, and in his last act of defiance, shouted out, "Heil Hitler! You know my name very well." The hangman wrestled the noose over his head, and Stryker's last words were, "Purim Feast 1946, a surprisingly astute reference to the biblical Book of Esther and its recounting of Haman's execution by hanging. He went on to scream, "The Bolsheviks will hang you one day." The observers reported that it was a messy execution. Stryker struggled on the gallows, and when the trap was opened, he went down kicking, and it was not a straight drop. Stryker's dying moans were heard for quite some time. In a final ironic twist, his ashes were placed in an urn under the name of Abraham Goldberg until they could be scattered. Chapter 8. Defendant Rudolf Hess. So plainly mad. Hess was noticeable because he was so plainly mad that it seemed shameful that he should be tried. His skin was ashen, and he had that odd faculty, peculiar to lunatics, of falling into strained positions which no normal person could maintain for more than a few minutes, and staying fixed in contortion for hours. He looked as if his mind had no surface, as if every part of it had been blasted away, except the depth where the nightmares live. Rebecca West, Greenhouse with Cyclamens 1, 1946. Diagrammatically, if one considers the street as sanity and the sidewalk as insanity, then Hess spent the greater part of his time on the curb. Douglas Kelly, 22 cells in Nuremberg, 1947. An enigma. In contrast to Stryker's sheer nastiness, the cadaverous, bushy-eyebrowed Hess posed enormous problems in psychiatric assessment. Compared to Goering's corrupt and extroverted hedonism, Hess was, well, different. He was an introvert who was rigidly honest and shy, but fanatically loyal to Hitler. Gilbert describes his dog-like devotion to his master. Hess complained intermittently of amnesia and constantly of aches and pains, and was convinced that the Allies were trying to poison him because they were hypnotically controlled by Jews. He would rock back and forth, moaning about abdominal pain, but this behavior could stop instantly if he was distracted. He seemed hollow and adopted bizarre postures throughout the trial. A courtroom observer remarked that he was gaunt and just not with it. "I'm no psychiatrist or psychoanalyst, but he looked to me like a man who had completely withdrawn from life and the developments around him." Medical observers shared this view. An editorial in The Lancet concluded that Hess's main probable diagnosis would appear to be paranoid schizophrenia, complicated by additional problems of hysterical amnesia, malingering, and negativism. On the other hand, some observers felt that Hess was primarily a skilled malingerer who hoodwinked countless experts. The British Experience Before Nuremberg. Hess had been imprisoned with Hitler in the 1920s and helped him write Mein Kampf. Subsequently, Hess led the Nazi Party and oversaw its activities in education, religion, and labor, as well as its outreach to international pro-Nazi bunds. Despite his unusual appearance and persona, he was a popular speaker in the early Nuremberg rallies, filling his speeches with mystic sentimentality and appeals for self-sacrifice. Hitler, he often said, is fulfilling a divine mission to German destiny. His other recurring theme was a militaristic cry for guns before butter. As Deputy Führer, he helped plan the invasions of Austria and Czechoslovakia. As the war dragged on, Hess's influence waned because of his eccentricities and because of jealousies within Hitler's inner circle. Hess tried to forestall a second front to the war, the approaching Nazi invasion of Russia, with a bizarre and grandiose scheme. He secretly flew to England in hopes of persuading the British to align with Germany against Russia. The British didn't know what to do with him, and a shocked Hitler furiously stripped Hess of his party membership and proclaimed him unsound. The British soon got a taste of this unsoundness, as we read in Chapter 4. The British psychiatrist suspected that Hess was a schizophrenic, noting, He was convinced he was surrounded by Secret Service agents who would accomplish his death by driving him to commit suicide, committing a murder staged to look like suicide, or administering poison in his food. Amnesia in Nuremberg. Hess has one of the best documented psychiatric histories of any political figure. His mental status changed repeatedly throughout his imprisonment, alternating between paranoia, amnesia, and preoccupations with his health. When he arrived in Nuremberg, one question dominated the court. Was he faking it? Dissembling mental illness is an ancient stratagem for prisoners. The Old Testament recounts that David simulated insanity to protect himself from the king of Gath by scribbling on the gateposts and drooling into his beard. 1 Samuel chapter 21, verses 12 through 15. Throughout history, defendants have pretended to be insane to avoid punishment. Was Hess just another instance of this? John Ammon, head of the American Army Interrogations Unit, thought so, as did many others. The following extracts give an idea of Ammon's interrogation. Whatever the source of his memory problems, Hess was a clever man. Ammon: When did you get the idea of losing your memory? When did you think it would be a smart thing? Hess: You imagine I think it would be a good idea to lose my memory to deceive you? Ammon: If you didn't remember your crimes, that would make it tougher for us, wouldn't it? You say you can't remember your wife's name, yet the British told us you wrote to her all the time. Hess: Ah, yes, I received letters from her, so I copied the name from the envelope. Subsequent interrogations continued in the same vein, Ammon always trying to trick Hess, Hess shrewdly claiming amnesia, and somehow or other always putting a spin on his response. If this were a soccer match, Ammon would have lost. Question: What was your last official position? Answer: Unfortunately, this already comes into a period which I cannot remember anymore. The doctor has told me that this is a frequent occurrence, especially in time of war, but that there is some chance that my memory will return. There are many cases where I cannot even remember what happened 10 or 14 days ago. Yesterday, I was told by a doctor that it happens sometimes that people don't even know their own names anymore, and he said that possibly by a shock it would suddenly all return again. This is terrible for me, and everything depends on it for me because I will have to defend myself in the process which is going to come soon. There is nobody to defend myself if I cannot do it myself. Question: You mean that you cannot even remember what your last official position was in Germany? Answer: No, I have no idea. It is just like a fog. Question: But you don't know what the proceeding is for? Answer: I have no idea. I don't even know whether I was told what I am accused of. I know that it is a political trial. Question: Do you know who Jews are? Answer: Yes. They are a people, a race. Question: You didn't like them very well, did you? Answer: The Jews? No. Question: So you had some laws passed about the Jews, didn't you? Answer: If you tell me, I have to believe it, but I don't know it. The interrogation continued the following day. Question: How is your memory today? Answer: The same. It hasn't altered any. I don't feel very well just now. I just had a cramp in my intestines. Question: When did you get this idea of losing your memory? Answer: I don't know. It is a fact that I don't have it now. Question: I say, when did you get the idea that it would be the smart thing to lose it? Answer: I don't quite understand that. You mean to say that I thought it might be a good idea to lose my memory and then deceive you like that? Question: Yes, that is just what I mean. Answer: Well, I can only say that that is not true. Question: Well, it might be very helpful in connection with the coming proceedings, might it not? Answer: I don't see the benefit I could derive from losing my memory there. Question: Oh, no, but, for instance, when you directed the murder of various people, which you did? Answer: I did that?
Question.
Yes, so the witnesses say.
Answer.
You mean that because I can't remember it, the witnesses are less credible?
Question.
Oh, somewhat.
Answer.
Or do you mean because I am lying?
Question.
To make people feel sorry for you also.
Colonel Ammon served Hess with his formal indictment in October 1945, and then returned 2 weeks later, accompanied by Kelly. On this occasion, Hess denied even recognizing Ammon, despite his many previous interrogations. This was going to be a hard struggle. When Hess arrived at Nuremberg, he passed Goering in the corridor and promptly said, "Heil Hitler," giving the Nazi salute. Yet he claimed later that he didn't know Goering. He told Warden Andrus that he needed his chocolates from Ashcan as part of his defense to show that the British were poisoning him. It was Andrus's opinion that Hess was a total fake. If Hess had amnesia, he asked Kelly, how is it that he could remember how to speak English? Andrus was obsessed with crashing through Hess's memory loss. He showed Hess movies of early Nuremberg rallies, but Hess claimed he still didn't remember. I must have been there because obviously I was there, but I don't remember. The interrogators tried to jog Hess's memory by bringing in his wife, his former secretaries, and his old professor. Hess didn't remember any of them. Warden Andrus felt that this proved Hess's homosexuality. After all, he and Hitler had shared a cell in Landsberg prison years before, and Hess could remember Hitler's name, but not his wife's. In a note to Kelly, Andrus confided, "We think that the only reason he remembers Hitler is because of abnormal sex relations with him. A homosexual naturally would tend to remember a man with whom he had abnormal sex relations, instead of his wife, with whom he had normal sex relations. We think that abnormality, homosexuality, might possibly be affecting memory." Andrus might have been a fine warden, but when it came to interrogation techniques, he had all the subtlety of a Mack truck. He suggested that Kelly could trap Hess by telling him, "You have all the other doctors fooled, but you're not fooling me. Since you and I are the only ones wise to the fact that your memory hasn't gone bad, I want to ask you something. If you get out of this trial all right, and I think you have a very good chance if I don't tell what I know, will you testify against the other prisoners? If you will not do this, then I will expose you." In the courtroom, Hess was seated next to Goering. Early in the trial, Hess whispered to Goering, "You'll see, this apparition will vanish, and you will be Führer of Germany within a month." Goering told Gilbert that with that statement, he was sure that Hess was crazy. The redoubtable Colonel Ammon interrogated Goering about Hess on October 9, 1945. Question. Did you think that Hess was telling the truth?
Answer. Yes, absolutely. He is completely changed, but he gives me the impression that he is completely crazy.
Question.
You say he seemed to be crazy before he went off on this flight?
Answer.
I wouldn't say outright crazy, but he was not quite normal then. And he was very exalted, so to speak, very exuberant.
Question.
Was he any worse at the time when he flew over to England than he had been before?
Answer.
In spite of the high position, he had relatively little to do after the outbreak of the war, and his ambition to do things may have caused his attitude. It was his wish all the time to do something decisive, and this made him very, very nervous. Then he probably also felt that his next subordinate, Bormann, was talking to the Führer and not telling him about it, and that may have added to it. Then he got the idea that he had to do something decisive, that he had to fly to England and bring about peace. In other words, to do something to compensate for his relative inactivity, which was forced upon him.
Goering told Kelly that Hess was always odd, and told another psychiatrist that Hess had been slightly off balance for as long as I can recall. Throughout it all, Hess kept to himself, goose-stepping across the jail's courtyard during his daily exercise. He was suspicious and uncooperative, and he kept a fastidious diary, reminding himself to avoid all sleeping pills and eggs, and to be very cautious about whatever he ate. Meanwhile, Justice Jackson finally agreed with Wild Bill Donovan that the court testimony had to become more riveting. The trial could not be just an endless dispute over documents, but it needed real testimony about the Nazi crimes themselves. As an initial step, the court viewed a film about the concentration camps. Gilbert and Kelly stood on either side of the dock to observe the defendant's responses. Here was a chance to see if Hess remembered anything. He was described as glaring at the screen and showing sustained interest, but he made no comment. When asked about Nazi crimes against humanity, Hess angrily rejected any responsibility and accused his British doctors of being the real abusers and torturers. The court's response to the international experts. The court was troubled by Hess's behavior and called in an international team of 7 physicians to examine him. The group included psychiatrists, neurologists, internists, and psychoanalysts, as well as Winston Churchill's personal doctor, who happened to be president of the Royal College of Physicians. The Journal of the American Medical Association noted approvingly in an article of March 23, 1946, that because of how this case was being handled, the role of the psychiatrist in the trial of the leading Axis war criminals has attained historical significance. Historical significance, certainly, but unanimity, hardly. The Russian doctors did not think Hess was schizophrenic and saw nothing in his behavior that should mitigate a sentence, preferably death. The British documented Hess's paranoia but felt that he could understand the proceedings and that ultimately he had a psychopathic personality. The Americans and French argued that Hess was not legally insane and that his amnesia reflected a mix of hysteria and malingering. Finally, the examining committee hammered out a consensus. Our examination revealed that Hess is not insane, has no disorder of consciousness, understands the nature of the proceedings against him. A part of the memory loss is simulated. It is probable that this type of response was originally developed consciously as a protective measure during a period of stress, that it has become habitual and has therefore become unconscious in part. The experts based their opinion on their personal examinations of Hess, but they were also very influenced by Hess's peculiar behavior in court. He ostentatiously paid no attention to the proceedings, took his earphones off, and instead read novels during some of the testimony. The experts saw this behavior as decidedly unusual and pointed out that a patient with true amnesia would have followed the testimony with interest. He therefore has a selective amnesia, hysterical in type. He has no brain disease as such, and his capacity for thinking is basically intact. The conclusion was thus that Hess was not insane, in the strict sense of the word. That was the kernel of the experts' reports. Hess could follow the proceedings, knew that he was on trial, but by virtue of his memory problems, might not be able to assist in his defense very well. What an interesting, nuanced summary. Hess's defense attorney argued predictably that if he could not assist in his own defense, he should not be tried. The prosecution countered that there was no evidence for a neurological origin of Hess's memory problems, and that whether his amnesia was malingering or unconscious in nature, the trial should proceed. Curiously, the Russian experts predicted that Hess might snap out of his amnesia during the trial. Such behavior often terminates when the hysterical person is faced with an unavoidable necessity of conducting himself correctly. Therefore, the amnesia of Hess might end upon his being brought to trial. Justice Jackson argued that since Hess had refused all treatment suggested for his amnesia, he was responsible for the consequences of his impaired ability to assist in his own defense. He is in the volunteer class with his amnesia. In England, as the reports show, he is reported to have made the statement that his earlier amnesia was simulated. He came out of this state during a period in England, then went back to it. It is now highly selective. That is to say, you can't be sure what Hess will remember and what he will not remember. His amnesia is not of the type which is a complete blotting out of the personality, of the type that would be fatal to his defense. In her observations on the trial, the novelist Rebecca West summed up Jackson's point more eloquently. Sanity is to some extent a matter of choice, a surrender to certain stimuli and a rejection of others. In this swirl of courtroom arguments, the judges were leaning toward excusing Hess from needing to be in the courtroom. A hearing was held on November 30, 1945, to decide the matter. Just before the session, Gilbert told Hess that he might be considered incompetent and excused from the proceedings. The court returned to session, and Hess's lawyer had begun to summarize the arguments for dismissing Hess on psychiatric grounds, when Hess suddenly stood up and shouted that he had made up the amnesia. "In order to anticipate any possibility of my being declared incapable of pleading, I would like to give the following declaration. Henceforth, my memory will again respond to the outside world. The reasons for simulating loss of memory were of a tactical nature. Only my ability to concentrate is, in fact, somewhat reduced. But my capacity to follow the trial, to defend myself, to put questions to witnesses, or to answer questions myself is not affected thereby." Kelly thought that Gilbert's suggestion undoubtedly upset Hess considerably, since he felt that to be denied a trial would indicate mental inferiority, and he felt that he must stand trial with his companions. His behavior reveals his hysterical nature and his desire to thrust himself into the limelight, fatal as it might be. Gilbert commented. He gave his declaration of malingering in court, apparently as a face-saving device. In later conversations, he admitted to me that he had not been malingering, and that he knew he had lost his memory twice in England. Kelly interviewed Hess the evening after his surprise announcement, and found him elated over his testimony, proud over fooling everyone, but all the same complaining that his memory wasn't quite right. Kelly regarded Hess's courtroom statement as a typical dramatic hysterical gesture, commenting that people who have recovered from mental illness will downplay their former symptoms to protect their ego. Hess: "How did I do? Good, wasn't I? I really surprised everybody, don't you think?" Kelly: "I shook my head and said I didn't think everybody." Hess: "Then I didn't fool you by pretending amnesia? I was afraid you had caught on. You spent so much time with me." Kelly: "I asked Hess if he remembered some movies that had been shown earlier of the top Nazis. At the time, he claimed he could not recognize the men." Hess: "Yes, I remember. I thought you knew I was pretending. All the time you looked only at my hands. It made me very nervous to know you had learned my secret." Hess explained that he started having memory problems in England, and when he realized that his interrogation sessions were shorter when he said that he couldn't remember, he decided to exaggerate his complaints of amnesia. The next day, Kelly found Hess increasingly preoccupied with delusional beliefs about poisoned food. Over the next 2 weeks, Hess was suspicious and increasingly distant. He started admitting that some of his memory problems were very real. Gilbert, ever lurking around the prisoner's dock and lunchroom, captured snippets of the other's opinions of Hess and his quixotic attempt to make peace with England. "Such stupidity, such childish naivete. It is disgraceful. It shows what irresponsible people ruled Germany." Hess's confession and behavior shocked the prisoners. Stryker said, "If you ask me, I think Hess's behavior was a shame. It reflects on the dignity of the German people." There were other opinions regarding the origins of his problems. Goering thought that Hess's oddness was caused by excessive masturbation. Noted Goering, "In strictest confidence, Hess couldn't satisfy his wife." Goering went on, "You know Hess isn't normal. He may have recovered his memory all right, but he is still suffering from a persecution complex. For instance, he makes remarks about a machine having been put under his cell to drive him insane with the noise of the motor. I told him I hear the same motor under my cell. He keeps coming out with remarks like that. I can't remember them all, but you might expect things like this. If the coffee is too hot, they are trying to burn him. If it is too cold, they are trying to upset him. He didn't actually say that, but that is the kind of thing he comes out with." With all of this swirling around, the court decided to accept Hess at his word, and he was allowed to continue attending the trial. Paradoxically, Hess's testimony clouded the picture further. As one of the Nuremberg attorneys described it, "Hess's statement kept him in the lawsuit and convinced us lawyers that he really was not very sound of mind, because he was out of the case and he'd talked himself back into it. He was about to get off on an insanity defense, Only a crazy person would stand up under such circumstances and announce that he had made it all up. Such considerations may have saved Hess from execution. Instead, he was sentenced to life imprisonment. All of this is confusing enough in the 21st century, but experts lacked a common psychiatric vocabulary in Nuremberg in 1945 and 1946. The court was troubled about how to proceed and did not know whether it should even allow Hess to testify. Kelly advised trying Hess and then seeking a psychiatric opinion about whether a death sentence was justifiable for someone in Hess's state of mind. Hess's postscript to the trial. After the trial was concluded on November 16, 1946, Hess wrote a long, meandering letter from prison to Sir Oswald Mosley, head of the British Union of Fascists. Mosley, who had been married secretly in Goebbels's Berlin house, was a longtime ardent fascist who spent time in Mussolini's company. He spent most of the war either in prison or under house arrest because of his political views. What on earth could Hess have hoped to achieve by writing to Mosley? In the National Archives, I found the typescript letter with Hess's handwritten edits in the margins. It is hard to convey just how peculiar this wandering document is. I think it supports the case for Hess's extensive paranoia and disorganization. He had nothing to gain from the letter. After all, he had already been sentenced to life imprisonment. The letter begins, "To be transmitted in the most secret way to Sir Oswald Mosley in London. A very high gratification will be granted later on." Hess continues, "The following is the first part of the intended, but never spoken, final word. In the spring of 1942, I suffered from an obstruction of my intestine. The doctor gave me laxatives. However, they did not produce any relief. Later, when I again drank cocoa, the stomach obstruction reoccurs." Hess details his bowel complaints for many pages, and the letter goes downhill from there. "There was unexplainable behavior of some people who were around me in England. These people were replaced from time to time. Some of those with me had a strange appearance in their eyes during the first days. They were glassy, dreamy eyes. The appearance of their eyes did not come to just my attention alone. Since the doctor, Dr. Johnston, who was with me in the spring of 1942, noticed them also. Dr. Johnston did not realize that he himself had the same eyes the first time he visited me. But now comes the important part. In one of the reports of the previously mentioned proceedings, specifically the Moscow proceedings, it states that the defendants had unusual eyes. They were glassy, absent, dreamy eyes." These passages do not read like the intellectually sharp Hess, who had duelled so well with his interrogator. Pages later, Hess repeated to Mosley excerpts from his closing statement to the Nuremberg court. "It was granted to me for many years of my life to serve under the greatest son, Adolf Hitler, which my people have brought forth in its thousand-year history. Even if I could, I would not blot out this period of my existence. I am happy to be a loyal follower of the Führer. I regret nothing." Kelly's assessment. Kelly saw Hess daily and wrote a report to Justice Jackson on October 16, 1945, noting that Hess seemed somewhat depressed but was competent and not particularly suspicious. Hess had unusual memory problems, however. He couldn't remember his birth date or any facts of his early life. Kelly requested authorization to administer an Amitol interview. The request was denied. Kelly worried that Hess was not eating enough, and Hess told him, "If they don't hang me, I can get fat then, when I am home. But if they do hang me, what difference will it make if I take medicine or more food than I care to?" Over the course of the trial, Hess felt that his stomach cramps improved and attributed the improvement to the homeopathic effect of the minute doses of poison which have been placed in my food. Both Kelly and Gilbert described how Hess continued to save samples of his food, placing bits of marmalade on blotter paper so that he could seal them up with red wax and send them to be analyzed for brain poison. He told Kelly that he couldn't get these ideas out of his mind and that he couldn't control them. "Even now, at times, these ideas come